What is going on, everybody? It's your boy, Big Dave Martell, on another episode here of Bog Hammer 40K, where we dig into the 40K universe, because in the grim dark of the far future, there is only war. And tonight, we have a really awesome panel. Like always, I have our boy co-host from Ari Akasha Institute, Mr. Tristan Powers. We have Mr. Nick. Mr. Mitty from Down Under, he's taking a break right now. He'll be right back. And also my longtime friend, e-friend, Mr. Tater, Lord Inquisitor Tater. What's up, guys?
Nothing much.
I'm doing pretty good, Dave. How's everyone?
So I'm fantastic.
Very, very cool. Very cool. So let's dig right into it. We're going to talk about tonight, Xenos and Chaos, the Chaos Gods more specifically. And the last episode of Boghammer 40K we did, we kind of did like an introduction into the setting, which I'm also kind of like a little bit of a noob with 40K. I'm only, you know, a few months into reading about the lore, and I finally think that I have a grip on what everything's all about. But I'm really, really fascinated about the Xenos and the Chaos Gods, because they're probably the two biggest adversaries of mankind within this universe. So we're going to go through and we're going to talk about the Xenos and the Chaos Gods and kind of some details about them and what makes them tick and the dynamics and everything about that. So we're going to dig right into it. What do you guys want to do? Tristan, what do you want to do first, Xenos or Chaos Gods?
Well, let's start with the Xenos. I have it here with a list. We're going to start with the Crafts World Eldar.
Very cool. Now, Mr. Tater, my boy from back in the day, Mad America Network, he's a big Warcraft or 40K fan as well. So let's start off with him. Tell us a little bit about that, Tater. Do you know about this?
Let's see. We were starting off with the Craft World Eldar.
Yeah.
Well, right. They live on these massive ships that are called Craft Worlds, first of all. That's where they get their name from. And these ships are basically a self-contained world. They're like planet-sized, much bigger than anything any of the other races have managed to build, as far as I know. And the reason for this is because these Craft World Eldar, thousands of years ago, when their race fell in the gigantic degenerate orgy that led to the birth of Slaanesh, the smart ones that saw this coming built these ships, got aboard them, and flew way off to the other side of the galaxy to get away from all that, because they knew that whatever was coming was bad, it was going to affect them, and they wanted nothing to do with it. So there's billions of them living on these ships. That's their home. And because it was their the Eldar that are able to see the future, the seers and farseers that saw this coming and saved them, they kind of built their culture and their entire system of government and military around these seers and farseers, basically letting them guide them to do whatever they need to do for their own survival.
That's very cool.
Yeah, the entire culture of the Craft World Eldar here are almost defined by the fact that they belong to what's called paths as a sort of behavioral function. So instead of allowing their emotions to run free and rampant and being subsumed by Slaanesh, they keep her at bay by taking on masks that support their role and function in society. So effectively, if you're going to be like a military hero, you know, you're a soldier or whatever, they don the mask of Cain and become a soldier. And as long as they're wearing that mask, they are a perfect warrior who feels no emotion, who knows everything about war, and they can access all the memories and training. But the second they take that off, they revert back to being a civilian who only loves music and art and could never hurt a fly. And that's how they sort of compartmentalize their emotions and everything, so they don't get overwhelmed or flooded in regular day-to-day life.
Very cool. So what is the significance of the Craft World Eldar? Mr. Tater, what is their relationship to mankind?
Well, first and foremost, they are self-serving dicks. Like I said, they use their seers and farseers to predict the future, look at different outcomes from different actions, and they decide whatever's going to help them most, that's what they're going to do. So there's been many times in the lore where they approach the humans acting as allies. They fight alongside each other to wipe out a horde of orcs, for example. And then as soon as that battle's over, the Eldar warp themselves back up to their ship and glass the whole planet, killing all the human forces on there. So they're self-serving, traitorous, but also very convincing because they're highly intelligent and they have psychic powers. So they're pretty persuasive, and they can get the humans to go along with this stuff more often than you'd think they should.
But they're considered Xenos, though, right?
Yeah, the general
policy
is...
they are considered formally Xenos. They're illegal.
Yeah, the typical Imperial shoot-on-sight policy, mostly applies, but there's times where they can talk them out of it and say, these orcs are a bigger problem.
Yeah, it has to be understood that... it has to be understood that the different crafts world are very independent from one another, so they're not always single unified factions. Some different crafts world have alliances or treaties with the Imperium, and some don't. They might, you know, they might slave raid them or something of that sort, which has provoked amongst the Imperium the notion that the Eldar are very perfidious because, you know, they can't tell one craft world from one another. So, they think, oh, these guys just... said we're going to be allies and then decided to raid us, and it was two totally different people.
And just so everybody knows, Tristan is not being an interruptive dick. He has a little bit of lag, and his timing's a little bit off, so I don't think that he's interrupted anybody.
Right, that is in fact the issue. I'm sorry, guys, if I end up interrupting you or anything, but just hold with me.
What's up, Kent?
Oh, yeah, not much, Kent. Just chilling.
All right, yeah. So, Mitty, we're talking about... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Sorry, yeah, go ahead. I was going to say, thinking about pouring me a vodka for when the podcast starts, but I'll give it a couple of minutes.
So, we're talking about the craft world Eldar. Do you have anything to add about them, Mr. Mitty? What do you think about them?
The craft world... Wait, we're not live right now, are we?
Yes, we are live.
Oh, no, I got nothing, bro. I got nothing. Jesus.
No, it's all good. So is there anything else that we need to cover about the craft world Eldar? Can we move on to the next Xenos?
No, I think we hit the major points. We also have to understand that the craft world Eldar, they have the belongings of the different fragments of Caelum and Chicane, which is the Eldar's war gods. War god effectively broke into many, many pieces when he fought Slaanesh. And also, when they die, they store the memories and souls of their ancestors inside a crystal matrix that has effectively given birth to the Inari.
Very cool. Who's next on the list for the Xenos?
Next, we have the Dark Eldar, everyone's favorite version of the Eldar.
Yeah.
So, the Dark Eldar are effectively the main culture and behavior model of the Eldar as they were thousands and thousands of years ago before the fall to Slaanesh. So they're rampant, murdering, backstabbing, dickish hedonists who live inside the Webway. And that's kind of like there were a bunch of people there who kind of were inside the Webway when the issue with Slaanesh happened and they didn't get their souls ripped apart. And they built a city there where Slaanesh can't get them. And in order to stave off Slaanesh from basically consuming their souls, they all effectively go around capturing slaves and then siphoning off the souls from them to extend their life forever. And, I mean, as long as they can continue to torture people and, you know, draw out their soul like that, then Slaanesh is placated and their souls don't get consumed. So, yeah, if you get caught by the Dark Eldar, you're in for a nasty beat of work.
Gross. So, Mitty, I want to let you know that I have screen share on, so whatever you type in the little chat on the side, everybody's going to see. So, just letting you know.
But, all right, thanks, bro. Fucking hell. At least I'm a good source of entertainment, right?
So, Mr. Nick, do you have anything to add about the Dark Eldar?
Can you hear me? Okay, there we go. From little I know, besides them being a little masochist, an important note is that the Adeptus Mechanicus actually employs some Dark Eldar to help maintain the Golden Throne, which we all know is the Emperor's life support system.
Ah, that's pretty strange. What do you...
Because they're a straight continuance from the original pre-fallen Eldar, they do in fact have probably the most advanced technology and understanding of the world, you know, scientific world of any of the other races. Especially in the field of biology, because they use it to torture people.
Oh, that's pretty cool. So, Tater, like, you know, since these guys are so gross and weird, why is it that the Emperor even messes with them at all?
Well, the Emperor himself hasn't actually dealt with the Dark Eldar. It was the segment of the Adeptus Mechanicus that's responsible for maintaining his life support device, the Golden Throne, that reached out to them, because they more or less forgot how the thing works after 10,000 years, and they needed a little help. So, these guys are the ultimate masters of biology. Like, they'll torture you by taking you into a lab and just totally dissecting you, like taking out all your organs, your ligaments, tendons, bones, arranging you around their laboratory, but you're alive and feeling it the whole time.
That's gross.
Right. The Dark Eldar are kind of masochist fucks that'll basically skin you alive, keep you as like a brain in a jar, and then rape your like skinned corpse while you're sitting at the table looking at yourself.
What?
Like, they get up to some really fucked up shit.
And they do all of it to stave off Slaanesh as well.
Yeah.
Joseph Mengele's experiments were like a kindergarten science project to these dicks.
That's a good way to put it.
So, we're blowing through time here. So let's move. I want to make a jump for my favorite Xenos. Can we do that? We're gonna go to the Tyranids. Mitty, tell us about the Tyranids.
So the Tyranids are basically a hive mind race of aliens that come from outside the known galaxy. And sorry, I'm having a mind blank here, but basically they infect other races with cults called gene stealer cults, and they integrate any other race into their own species and use the best parts of them to help continue their slow takeover of the known galaxy.
That's really terrifying. So
So whenever the Tyranids invade a planet, they basically liquefy all of the organic and inorganic components and reduce it down to its base state, and then suck it up and then use it to make more Tyranids.
And also, don't they have, like, when they're coming, they have some sort of something that blocks psychic communication so that their targeted planet can't call for help?
Right. Yes. They have the Shadow in the Warp, which is the psychic presence of the Tyranid hive mind, and somehow it's basically like a giant blank spot in the warp. That was probably developed as some sort of defense reaction because they don't really use psyker powers themselves. But effectively, it short circuits all the astropathic communication, so you can't even call for help. And most psykers, when they encounter this, effectively go mad.
I've also seen it described as a distributed denial of service attack against the warp. Like, there's so many Tyranid minds with their psychic connection to the hive mind that any humans, Eldar, even demons or whatever, can't get through it to contact their source of their own psychic power. So they're just totally cut off for that reason.
Wow. And pretty much, you know, I've read that once Tyranids have a significant infestation on a planet, they use the Exterminatus. Isn't that right, Mr. Nick?
Yeah, they'll. I mean, it's like any other generic alien race you can think of, like say Zerg from StarCraft. It's the planet's far gone. They'll just pulp it and start again. There was the first encounter the Imperium of Man had against Tyranids. I believe it was Inquisitor Kripman was spearheading the defense of, and going a bit off topic with him is he was considered so violent that even the Inquisition was like, oh, that's a little too much, man. But his Basically. He had a strategy of scorched earth against the Tyranids where he exterminated dozens of planets just to make a dead zone between the Imperium and the Tyranid Swarm in the hope to starve them out on the advance.
And did it work?
And it did appear to be working. And yeah, I mean, it did work effectively. And they just realized, they just had the idea that it was taking so much resources to do so and killing so many Imperial servants that they couldn't keep doing it because Kripman wanted to just exterminate its entire sectors of space.
Yeah, I believe it had more casualties, or at least the casualties rivaled the amount during the Horus Heresy with his plan.
That's incredible. So, Mr. Tater, like, what are kind of like this? Because I know that when the Tyranids infect a planet, there's kind of like they come in stages, right? They come in these stages. They like first they infect with a gene stealer cult, which is something that it's not just like they pop up or whatever. They infect the genes of a certain species of people, and they start breeding these people, and they effectively work from within society over generations, and then eventually they just start dropping these, like, you know, these insectoid kind of looking things that just show up, and then it's just like a big war. And by the time they start dropping, it's already you're already infested. It's over. Am I right with my analysis there?
Yeah, that's more or less correct. The gene stealers, when they encounter humans, they'll infest them with gene stealer DNA. And these are considered the first-generation gene stealer cultists. Unless you run a DNA screening on them, they just look like who they were beforehand. Like, there's no way to tell. Then they go back to their home planet, and they reproduce. Their children are a little messed up. And then when those children reproduce, they're real messed up. Like, they'll have a pale, purplish tone to their skin, extra limbs, like common depiction of a third generation gene stealer cultist. They're bald with three arms, and they totally reject Imperial authority. They stage uprisings. They have their own cult, like religious cult. That's why they're called gene stealer cults. And if you happen to be on a planet where you hear people talking about the four-armed emperor, you're in big trouble because these are these gene stealer cultists. They're worshiping some kind of Tyranid monster. And they're...
Yeah, that's the tough thing about the gene stealers is that they're extremely smart about how they infiltrate society. So in some places, they might set up as a religious cult. And in some places, they might set up as like a secret society, or they'll infiltrate the ruling dynasties and set it up as like a... you know, like a pageantry type of thing, or, you know, they differ based on how they think they might be able to best do it, which makes it very, very difficult to track and very, very deadly because it's effectively a great strategy.
All right. I'm taking a question. I'm sorry. Let me, I'll get right to you, Mr. Bindi. I got to read the chat real quick. We got a diamond from Miss Mother Hen. Everybody make sure you go follow, the real Mother Hen. She's absolutely wonderful. That's Rory's wife. She's a really, really great lady that always has really, really great, insightful things to say. We love Mother Hen over here. So many blessings to you, Mother Hen. Thank you for the diamond. Verbo, Mr. Rory, says wants to know, where do you start to learn about 40K?
That's I responded in the chat forum. That's I'm the War Master. Wee-woo. Lexicanum.com is the 40K be-all, end-all of... knowledge. If you want to sit through that and read through articles, that's how, when I first got into 40K, I really learned a lot about the knowledge and then branched off from there.
Very cool. I would suggest there's a few videos.
It's a pretty great place to start.
Yeah. Hang on a second. Rory says my mic is lower than everybody else's. There, that should be better. So I would suggest, Tristan, you showed me a couple videos a while back from this guy, Lutin09, L-U-E-T-I-N-09, and it's called, he's got like a three-part series called, it was called The Emperor of Mankind or something. It's like 4 hours of stuff, but it's really, really great, and it's really, really cool stuff. It's very, very good content. It's, yo, he did a really good job with it. And then also, my first introduction to 40K was I watched what's it called? It's like a fan made video, Hell's Reach. It's like an animation on YouTube.
Hell's Reach is an excellent introduction.
Yeah,
I meant to watch that still.
Yeah, it's great. It's really, really great. You watch that in the first 5 minutes, you're going to be hooked to 40K. You're absolutely going to love it. The main character is Reclusiarch Grimaldus, and he's this like stewing, you know, regal, brave, heroic guy. He's just, oh man, it's awesome. It's really, really awesome. And the way that he reads it, the guy that narrates it is like, he's got like a light British accent, and he's just, Reclusiarch Grimaldus, and it's really awesome. So I would check that out.
They sound like someone who should be voicing a space marine.
Yeah, it's really, really good stuff. And then also there's another one called A Border Prince or whatever. And he does audiobooks of short stories. And man, when I was working, I'd have my earplugs in, and I would mow through like five or six of these a day. They're so cool.
Right. I'd also like to tell everyone to go watch Wolf Lord Row. He's probably my favorite.
He's very good.
He does readings of the various books and segments of the everything. Absolutely great. Love that guy.
And for hilarious quick takes, you can check out Major Kill. He's an Aussie guy on YouTube, does really funny videos.
And if you want another one who's very good, is Baldemort's Guide to Warhammer. He's very nice to listen to. And usually the first third of the video, he will narrate a short story of whatever the topic is and then go into depth about each particular subject.
Yeah, there's another channel called, I think it's called 40K Theories or whatever, and they got like xenozoology and like all kinds of. And there's a lot of great channels out there. Start with the Lutin09 and the Master of Mankind, and because that kind of gives you the basis, like the philosophical foundation of Warhammer 40K, and it's such a cool setting, man. You're good. You watch that and you watch Hell's Reach, you're hooked. You're going to be obsessed with it. It's just, there's no way around it. So, Mr. Mitty, I'm sorry, before I interrupted you, what were we going to say?
So I have a question for the panel, which is, so we know that Tyranids can incorporate orc biomass into their species, which is terrifying, but do they ever infiltrate orc societies like they do human?
They have tried to do it before, but the orcs have a sort of mental... discernment amongst them that they always end up killing the Tyranid infiltrators for not being orky enough.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah, and then orcs as well is probably one of the best defenses in the galaxy against Tyranids, because many times Eldar and humans have managed to sway or direct Tyranids towards orcs and vice versa, and that becomes like orcs, they fucking love it. They love fighting Tyranids, and Tyranids just want the fight and want the organic matter, so it's really sort of like a win-win situation.
Well, Warboss Gazgul launched an entire warg against a Tyranid invasion and successfully fought it off.
Yeah, the main thing for the Tyranids against the orcs is that the orcs are capable of pushing up so much of a fight, and they don't really give a shit about casualties because they'll just make more mushroom people, right? So effectively, they can knock the Tyranids out just by causing an issue where they end up causing so much of a damage to the Tyranids that the eventual benefit of eating the orc in the planet, it doesn't match up, so they end up losing biomass.
And speaking of, I think this is a good segue into orcs, Tristan mentioned they called them mushroom people, and that's probably kind of strange to somebody that's familiar with Dungeons & Dragons or familiar with Lord of the Rings, or familiar with like old Saxon lore or whatever, where the orcs are either depicted as some kind of like demon spawn, or they're just like this bestial subhuman, you know, monster, bipedal, you know, monster. It's they are a bipedal monster, but they are also they reproduce almost like a fungus. Their skin is green.
Right, they're spore-based.
Yeah, and they literally spread based on spores. So when, you know, speaking of dropping the Exterminatus, people are familiar, the Exterminatus is essentially like a mega nuke. They drop this mega nuke on a planet and just eliminate everything. It just eviscerates or it incinerates all life on a planet. So whenever they find that a planet has an orc infestation, they pretty much just like they just have to exterminatus it because it's just there's no coming back.
Well, you know that's not entirely true. Sometimes orc infestations can be dealt with. You know, if you see orcs have an interesting racial ability where they effectively get more advanced and stronger the more orcs they are. So if you can destroy enough of them and keep them their population down low enough, they'll eventually revert down to what's called feral orcs, which are effectively like super like Iron Age primitive orcs you'd find in like a fantasy setting where all they have is like huge axes and like wielded armor and shit. Like the kind of orcs that anyone would be familiar with, right?
And they're go ahead.
So if you can keep them down like that, you can effectively just use them as training fodder for your own militias, and as long as you're very on top of it, you can deal with it on a planetary scale and they won't come back and destroy everything.
And something to be said about the orcs, these orcs in 40K, they operate pretty much everything with psychic power. Everything from there, and they're not really aware of it. They think that they're piloting it. But it's their collective belief in the operation of the machine that makes it work. Everything from their spaceships down to, you know, their guns, which is a pretty cool thing because you shoot an orc in the face, you try to pick up his gun, it's not going to work because you're not an orc. And this goes to the
because
their
it's just a
well.
It's just a pipe welded together with bubble gum and tape. I mean,
yeah,
it works for an orc because it's their psychic power making it work. But to everyone else, it's just a rusted pile of junk.
Yeah, and you know, there's these things in 40K called Titans. They're these large bipedal tanks that get pretty huge, but the orcs will put them together with literally just scrap everywhere, and because they collectively believe that this Titan works, it operates, and they're really damn effective. But if you kill all the orcs inside, or if you damage this thing enough, or if you kill enough of the orcs, the thing will actually just fall back into rubble. Mr. Tater.
The orc Titans, they call them Stompas because they don't have sophisticated words for things. They're supposed to be like British football hooligans, but dumber. And I've actually read descriptions in the books of Stompas approaching and the humans describing the sounds of screeching metal from the unlubricated joints in these giant pieces of junk that are actually formidable somehow. The Mechanicus can't figure out how it works because it actually doesn't. And they're big, ugly, and tough, just like the orcs themselves.
And an example of how potent the collective orc psyche is that there's a now invincible member of the Imperial Guard called Sebastian Yarrick, who became infamous among the orcs for being such a successful crusader against their own species that they started to spread rumors that he was invincible. And now, due to the fact that almost all orcs across the galaxy believe that Yarrick is invincible, he has actually become unkillable.
Right. So, I mean, he's effectively like this old, like, you know, 290-year-old guy who's about to drop dead. Except when he's fighting orcs, he turns into like this badass because the orcs believe that Commissar Yarrick is this super badass warlord who can look at you and kill you with laser vision and can strike your head off with a single blow of his fist and shoot you from 1,000 yards away. And when he's fighting these orcs, it effectively becomes true because all of the orcs collectively believe that this is correct.
Now, Mr. Nick, the orcs have a pretty weird religion. They don't worship the chaos gods, but they have their own religion. Are you familiar with this?
Yes, they actually worship the twin gods of Gork and Mork. And I may be getting these confused, but everyone does. That Gork is the god who's cunningly deadly and
cunningly brutal, right?
And cunningly brutal, and then yes, and then Mork is the god who's brutally cunning. And they're, I think, forever fighting each other just for the fun of it. But I'm losing my track of thought. I believe in fantasy. Warhammer Fantasy, there was a point where Gork and Mork merge into the singularity orc god, and that's all I got, to be honest. it's tough for the orc gods, but yeah, they worship them, and they see the emperor as well as some sort of like they recognize the emperor as a deity, but like the Humi Gork and Mork essentially.
They believe that the emperor is the human's biggest war boss.
Yes, yeah, that's
what and he has all the authority because clearly he's the biggest.
Yeah, because yeah, that's kind of how orc society works. If you are the biggest one, you become the boss until somebody kills you, and then that you know. So it's really common in orc band or orc war bands. They'll just like start breaking out into a fight over pretty much nothing. And somebody will get killed, and then that guy becomes boss. It happens like constantly.
Yeah, there's always power struggles in the orc hierarchy. It really is a pecking order of the biggest and the greenest is the meanest, and everyone else believes that. And which also, with their orcs' latent psychic powers, makes it true. And the funny thing about orcs is that it's sort of the ideal libertarian. Society, because the economy is never inflated, because orcs use teeth as their currency, yeah, and all orcs constantly grow teeth, pull teeth, and I think they degrade over time, so nobody really has a ruling amount of money. It's all sort of an innately self-regulated society.
Yeah, and these orcs will actually punch their own teeth out to buy things.
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
or that's... punch someone else's teeth out, because they need some change.
Yeah.
There is a tribe of orcs who are the richest, the Bad Moons. It's because their teeth grow the fastest.
That's so cool. I love that.
They do have a lot of colors, have a lot of symbolism in orc culture, too. As we all know, red goes the fastest, which even becomes true when orcs fight blood angels, because blood angels have red power armor. They are actually given a faster reaction time against orcs. Much to the orc detriment, but it also, like, blue, I believe, is luck, and then, as Tater said, yellow is for wealth.
Green is the best.
They think that ultramarines are lucky gits, which, when they're fighting them, actually, they become luckier in battle.
That's really interesting. So, we could be here about orcs all night. Everybody loves orcs. But one final thing about the orcs is they kind of have a thing where they have a crusade of their own, Tristan, right?
Yeah, it's called the Great Wa, and Wa is effectively how they pronounce the term war, but it's effectively their term for when the orcs all march to war against a single foe for the hell of it. It's the Great Wa.
And they'll go ahead.
Yeah, in the modern day, the Great Wa is being led by the Supreme Orc Ghazkul Mag'ulak Thraka.
Very cool. Yeah, and these when they start the Wag or Wa or whatever, however you say it, it's like collective psychic power on a really really great level, and they'll get into some busted old like ship that was like some like I think I was reading one of the biggest ones was they got onto a Space Hulk or something like that, which is like a really really ancient gigantic ship, and they just started like tumbling through the galaxy, gaining more and more momentum until they finally crashed in, I believe it was Earth, right? They crashed into Earth, and then they just like spilled out and started this big giant war, if I remember correctly.
Right, that was during the War of the Beast, a couple thousand years after the internment of the Emperor, blessed be his soul. And it was effectively the greatest peril the Imperium of Man has ever faced, aside from the Horus Heresy. It required the Primarch Vulcan to effectively come back and destroy the Beast.
That's incredible.
And Wa can start from something as simple as a bar fight, which is, not a bar fight, but just like some brawl in the middle of an orc clan that just collectively becomes bigger and bigger until it spreads that all of a sudden it's they're starting a war. They just originate from the stupidest, tiniest of things that just escalate and escalate and escalate between clans.
That's nuts.
Right. So you see, one of the funny psychological things about an orc is that they're drawn both consciously and unconsciously to other orcs and extreme violence. So if there's a bunch of orcs fighting on some planet somewhere, they will actively begin to pull in orcs from all the surrounding regions of space to come fight, whether they know it or not. And as the war gets bigger and more deadly and more glorious and more orcs are on that world, the amount of orcs they start drawing in becomes larger and they start drawing in from more people. So you can see how this sort of as a snowball effect, and eventually it becomes a great war where there's just so many orcs present and it's drawing in so many of them constantly that it's it's like a never ending war.
Very cool.
There's one last thing. Sorry, the point out about orcs. I think we can't go on without discussing is I know Tater's familiar with Tuska Daemon Killer.
Oh yeah,
very notable orc.
Yes, he is. You want me to explain him to the folks?
Yeah, just go ahead, and then afterwards we're going to go to Folkish Farmer, who actually just donated a diamond. Thank you, Folkish Farmer, and a diamond from Verbo. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you very much. So, Tuska Daemon Killer was an orc war boss who was leading his orc boys on a battle somewhere where they encountered a demon. Now, the chaos gods have lesser demons and greater demons. The demon he encountered was called a bloodthirster, a greater demon of Khorne, the war god. So, big, massive, demonic killing machine, and he takes one look at this thing and decides it's going to be a great fight, fights it, wins, decides it's the best fight he ever had. So then he figures, I got to go fight more of these things. Gets the boys together, and he heads for the Eye of Terror, which is a breach in reality. The warp is leaking through. It's also heavily guarded by the Imperium of the Man. Or the Imperium of Man, because they don't want anything getting in or out. And he sneaks past the defenses somehow, flies into the eye, and once he gets there, Tuska and his boys are just looking for demons and killing them, just fighting as much as they can, and they're loving it. So Khorne himself, the god of war, sees these orcs fighting and killing his demons, and he likes them so much that when they all finally die, he takes them to what is called the Anvil of Khorne, where he has the best fighters that he's ever seen fight to the death every day, kind of like a grimdark Valhalla. So every day, Tuska Daemon Killer wakes up, fights to the death against a bunch of demons with his boys, dies, has the time of his life. He's basically in heaven doing this.
Yeah, or Kevin.
That's incredible. All right, guys, we're going to switch over to Folkish Farmer, who's also a 40K fan, but we're going to see what he's got. He's going to make us some liver, so we're going to check out some of his cooking here. We'll be back in a short minute. Hail to Folkish Farmer.
Hey guys, welcome to the Folkish Farmer. Today we're going to talk a little bit about liver. And liver is a super nutritious meat. It's something that's quite often overlooked. And since everyone's in quarantine and everyone is at the stay-at-home orders and all the stupid nonsense that's going on, liver is something that is readily available at the grocery store. You can walk by the ground beef and it's gone, or the pepperoni, or the sandwich meats, but I pretty much assure you liver is there. And it's a great meat. The amount of vitamins that is in a serving of liver is amazing. From the B vitamins, the A vitamins, there is more vitamin A in a serving of liver than there is in a carrot. So think about that. So this is why it was so important to the diet of our ancestors. Our ancestors really strived after this organ meat. It's high in protein. It's really a superfood. You know, a lot of people think of like goji berries and, you know, exotic things like that as a superfood. Liver is a superfood. Bacon, maybe not so much, but bacon enhances the flavor, and we all like bacon. So what I'm actually doing here is I've took some skewers, and I'm going to take a little piece of liver right here. and I'm just going to put it right over the strip of bacon, and I'm going to add my fresh sage to it with a little bit of chives, and I'm essentially just going to roll this guy up just like this, and just make sure it's tucked in there, make sure to get all the nice bacon fat around that. That's going to really enhance the flavor of this guy's, really is. So I've got that rolled up there. I'm just going to stick it right here on the skewer. And now essentially what I'm going to do is I'm going to take some butter. I'm going to put that in a cast iron. And I'm going to fry that up for about 5 minutes each side. And I'm going to stick it in the oven at 300 for about 5 minutes. And I'm going to serve this up. This is a quick, easy dish for us. So I'm actually just going to serve it up some rice. And we have fresh asparagus from our garden. So I'll be plating some fresh asparagus. So some of the first things from our garden coming this year, asparagus. Very nice. And remember, guys, for the greater good, eat your liver. And I'll see you guys soon.
All right. Many blessings to Folkers Farmer, man. He does such a good job with those cooking videos. Really, really great stuff. And, you know, some really, really great advice in there about eating liver. And, you know, organ meat in general is something that's very overlooked when it comes to Western and especially American diets. We, you know, I remember growing up and we always used the innards from the turkey on Thanksgiving to make gravy or to just eat. We used to fight over it. It was very surprising when I started to go to other people's houses, you know, especially my wife's family, you know, they throw it out. I was like, what are you throwing that out for? But that's something that's very common in American households, not just with the turkey innards, but innards in general are considered to be gross. And when in actuality, they're extremely good for you. They're full of nutrients and vitamins and all kinds of stuff, you know, minerals and very, very high in iron. And they're just really, really great. And we should, as people that are trying to get in touch with our ancestral diet and our ancestral ways and our folk ways of generations past, we should try to incorporate what our ancestors ate into what we eat today, and that includes innards. They're really, really delicious. They're very strong in flavor, and they're excellent for you. Now, at the end of the video there, Mr. Folkish Farmer said, eat your liver for the greater good, and then pointed to his miniatures there, his towel miniatures, and that's the last Xenos that we're going to talk about tonight. Mr. Tristan, what do you think about the towel?
Well, as most of the people here would agree with me, the Tau are a bunch of fish-faced merchant pucks, effectively. So effectively, they have a thing called the Spheres of Expansion, which are in a circle from the Tau homeworld, and they have a colonized some amount of space. Compared to the Imperium of Man, it really is a diminutive of amount. So the Tau are a very technologically advanced race in comparison to the Imperium. They have a lot of excellent projectile weaponry, and they also use combat suits, which are effectively like giant mecha. The Tau have a lot of Asian influence in their sort of culture and behavior. And they believe in a quasi-religious structure called the Greater Good, which effectively is some sort of like a collectivist, communist idea that no one is an individual in Tau society. Everyone serves the entire good of the entire, all of everyone, right? And rather uniquely amongst the races of 40K is that the Tau are very diplomatic. They actually have a confederation of different races of various aliens and Xenos that they have brought into the greater good and brought into, you know, the Tau fold of some sort. They have And they put them into different uses based on what the different races might be very, very good at. For instance, one of the races they use as mercenaries because Tau are actually not very great at hand-to-hand combat. And they also sometimes do take in people, which they refer to as Gui La, which are effectively just traitorous humans who have ceased to worship the Emperor and join forces with the Tau. So the Tau effectively subvert everyone when they come in with diplomats. So When a planet interacts with Tau first, they tell them, you know, we just want some diplomatic relations. We'll have some trade concessions. Like, here's some of our great goods. With the, you know, extreme technology, we have entertainment. We'll ship you movies and televisions and, you know, all these kinds of things that people would like. And over time, their influence and their structure builds up to where they start demanding more and more concessions and, you know, eventually introduction into the Tau society as the greater good.
Sounds pretty kosher.
And that comes with also, they are a very subversive people, as many memes have pointed out in the past.
Tater, what do you think about the Tau? You're muted.
Sorry about that. Well, personally, I think the Tau are a little full of themselves. Like, I've read a Farsight novel where he was analyzing combat footage between the Tau and the Imperium of Man, and he analyzed the way Space Marines were fighting for hours and hours and hours, and after watching hundreds of hours of footage of Space Marines fighting, it finally hit him. Oh, they understand tactics.
So, but they're pretty weak with hand-to-hand combat. So what was the solution?
Really, the biggest solution the Tau have for their hand-to-hand combat weakness is their long-range firearms, which are honestly probably better than most of what the Imperium of Man has, especially the Imperium or the Imperial Guard. Like, they have plasma rifles that don't blow up and kill you like the Imperial plasma guns. They have these mobile battle suits with powerful weapons mounted on the arms and jetpacks so they can flit around and get away from you. But more or less, if a Space Marine gets up close to a whole squad of Tau, they're all dead.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the basic Tau weaponry is the charge rifle, which both outdistances and outpowers the Imperial Guard's flashlight, effectively. But one of the major things that makes their Tau so powerful is that they're not adverse to using artificial intelligence with drones and whatnot, which is very, very dangerous in the 40K universe, because unknowns to the Tau, AI has a history of being taken over by chaos and going rogue.
And that's why it's a heresy in the Imperium.
Correct.
Right. In the current day Imperium, heresy is, or the AI is referred to as abominable intelligence, because it was effectively the what ended the golden age of humanity.
Wow. And we are starting to run out of time, but I want to at least do a quick overview of Chaos. So we're going to kind of go through the Chaos gods and who they are. And I know this is such a big element, but we'll touch on them on another episode. But give us a quick overview of who the gods are, Mr. Tristan. Chaos gods.
Right. So first we have Khorne, who is the god of chaos and, or the god of bloodshed and nobility and war and sacrifice and struggle and god of rage. He is effectively war personified and incarnate. He is constantly angry, constantly rageful. All of his demons are effectively demons of battle and rage and slaughter. And he has the famous slogan, blood for the blood god. Khorne cares not from whence the blood flows, only that it does. So then we'll go on to Khorne's main rival, which is Slaanesh. Slaanesh is the youngest of the chaos gods, the prince of pleasure and pain. She was the downfall of the Eldar race, who were massive hedonists and degenerates, and they effectively gave birth to Slaanesh, and in the birth of Slaanesh, she consumed all of the Eldar, and they paid for their hubris. She is a hermaphroditic entity and can change between genders at will. As you might know, it's very much a degenerate sort of thing, but he's also the god of perfection and attainment and pride. So there are positive aspects to Slaanesh.
So real quick, we got a donated in Genie from Focus Farmer. Much love, Mr. Farmer. Says, the Tau are great. Eat your bat soup, bigot, for the greater good. Thank you, Focus Farmer. Appreciate you. Yeah, no love for the towel. No love for the towel. As you guys admitted, the tower are pretty, technologically advanced. So I'm assuming in the tabletop game that they're probably pretty effective.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at. Is this actually a meme that everyone hates the tower because the tower is so effective on the tabletop that they've become despised almost as a sort of meme, because a lot of the players, when you go up against them, it's actually very, very difficult to fight Tau unless you have an army specifically designed to do so.
Yeah. So you mentioned Slaanesh and Khorne, and then there's three others, correct?
Two others. There is the god Tzeentch, who is the god of god of intrigue and sorcery. And politics. He's a master schemer. He is fate personified. He effectively just sits around creating plots in order to plot. The plot is the end goal in and of itself. And he is also the god of sorcerous knowledge and magic. So he collects all of the knowledge of the universe and stores it and keeps it. He is the patron of the Thousand Suns, and also led to the fall of Magnus. Did in fact do things wrong. I don't want to hear anything otherwise.
And then there's Nurgle, right?
Right. So then there is Nurgle, who is the god of death and decay, rot, disease. He is the plague father. He effectively believes that all living things should be given into death and rebirth. So he's kind of like the cycle of nature. Except he has such a totally inhuman perspective of nature that he believes giving people diseases and killing them in that sort of sense and repurposing them, putting in them into a slurry of maggots and, you know, bile and everything, is effectively a good, kind gesture.
Very cool. So we're going to go down to panel, and I'm going to ask everybody in closing, which of the Chaos Gods is their favorite and why? Maybe a story that they're associated with, or just something that they, like, what is their favorite Chaos God? We're going to start with Tater. Tater, which is your favorite Chaos God? And what is your favorite Xenos?
Well, favorite Xenos is going to be orcs, because let's be real here. They're a bunch of fun. Like, if you ever find anything written from their perspective, definitely read it, because, they're morons, first off. They're entertaining for that reason, and they're always hitting each other. It's good fun. And as far as if I absolutely had to pick a Chaos God, might be going against the grain here, but I would go with Nurgle, because out of all the four, he's the only one that at least pretends to be proud of his followers. And, like, everything he does to you, Tristan was saying, he thinks he's doing you a good thing. Like, you follow him, you spread a disease somewhere. If he finds it, if he's pleased by that, he'll tell you, you have done well. Here is a new gift. Some boils. And COVID-19.
Yeah. Mitty, who's your favorite Xenos and who's your favorite Chaos God?
Being raised by a Cockney Englishman, I'd have to say my favorite Xenos are the orcs. But my favorite Chaos God would definitely have to be Nurgle, because unlike the other Chaos Gods, as Tater said, he does actually legitimately care for his worshippers, which is unique. As Tristan said, Khorne doesn't care for where the blood flows from, just the blood flows. So if one of his worshippers die, that's fine, because blood will flow. Slaanesh cares not for its followers. It cares only for more and more pleasure and pain. Tzeentch is such a dick to its own followers that it will sometimes turn them into chaos spawn for no reason, just because it's random and unexpected. Whereas Nurgle, he gifts his followers. He takes pride in them. And on top of that, it can be said that the greatest brotherhood amongst all chaos warbands are those of the Plague Marines. Nurgleites have a special kind of bond between each other, where they feel an authentic sense of of brotherhood and pride in their mission and their god, which is quite unique amongst those living in the 40K universe.
And Mr. Nick, who's your favorite Xenos and who's your favorite Chaos God?
Well, I have to go with orcs only because I've known orcs for so long. It's the sheer Cockney redneck ingenuity of them is great, and they're the only source in the entire lore of any sort of levity. So they're a good comic relief. And just to go against the grain here, I'm going to say Khorne, because Khorne seems to be just a Megadeth concert happening all day, every day with axes.
And Mr. Tristan, favorite Xenos, favorite Chaos God?
Well, I was going to go with the orcs as well, but since everyone decided to go with them, I'll go for a different one and shoot off here. My favorite Xenos are the Exodite Eldar. So unlike the Craftsworld or the Dark Eldar, the Exodites were the original people who decided that their society is just so corrupt and cannot be saved, and effectively dropped all of their technology to go live on isolated planets in the wilderness by themselves, living like naked spear chuckers with dinosaurs. And they're effectively the most virtuous Eldar. They don't have to do the paths. They have no Owan Slaanesh. They have reverted down the primitive traditionalism so hard that they have escaped the fate of the Eldar.
And your favorite Chaos God.
My favorite Chaos God, I'm going to have to go with Khorne. For a slightly different reason here. Khorne is also a god of martial honor and nobility in that sense. He doesn't just want people to die just because. He also wants people to die in a good fight. He wants warriors to fight and die and slaughter in his name and to die in a glorious battle. And because of this, he and his followers will often allow, for instance, 1v1 duels. And they won't use subversive tactics. They won't use ambushes. They won't trick people. They just want to go 1v1, me, you, right now. We're going to fight, and whoever walks away first is the one who is the best. And I have to respect that about Khorne, that he's fair, he's honest, he knows exactly what he wants, and it's slaughter.
For me, my Xenos is tied for two. Everybody already said orcs. Yeah, so obviously they're tied for first. But my other favorite Xenos is the Tyranids. Tyranids are absolutely terrifying. They're absolutely inhuman, and there's just like this looming dread with the Tyranids. It isn't with the other Xenos. The Tyranids almost feel unstoppable. Like when we were talking about how they have the psychic blackout thing. You know, once the Tyranids reveal themselves, it's over. You know what I mean? You have to just say your prayers and just fight till you die. They're really despicable and bizarre and very insect-like. They have no feelings. There's nothing human about them. And for that reason, I think that they're pretty terrifying and they're pretty cool. As far as Chaos Gods, probably my... We didn't mention Malice. Malice is a cool semi-chaos god because he hates all the other chaos gods. But I'm going to have to go with Nurgle as well, because just probably the first short story I listened to was about Nurgle. It was about a space marine that came into contact with one of Nurgle's high demons, who was in this pit of like molten, rotten flesh that had exploding boils of noxious fumes coming out, and this giant demon, it's pretty much a giant rotten face, came out of the molten pit and pretty much took over the guy and psychically dominated him and turned him to a warrior of Nurgle. Well, this warrior of Nurgle, who was He was accompanied by a young lady that he fancied, that was from the Adeptus Sororitas or whatever they're called, the ladies or whatever. And he was along with her, and she escaped. She managed, she hit her jetpack, she flew up out, the jetpack exploded, she was in really bad shape, they put her back together. And over years, her entire career, she spent trying to find him and hunt him down and stuff like that. Meanwhile, he kept getting more and more corrupt and more powerful, as they mentioned about Nurgle. He gives more and more powers as you go along, and eventually he just completely loses who he was before, and he just becomes this rotten Nurgleite, monstrous warrior. And he has like this shield that's made of living flesh, it has bones and like all this kind of stuff. And the shield actually like screams in pain when he blocks things. But anyway. So the story goes is they finally locate this guy and this lady who was not supposed to go hunt him anymore. She got ordered that she wasn't supposed to, did it anyways. And she went and she saw him and she fought him again. And she like saw him and this and that. And she's like, hey, you're still in there. I know you're still in there. And she invoked the emperor's name and stuff. And then he realized who he was. And he goes back to Nurgle. And after he was supposed to kill this lady, and he goes back to not Nurgle, but the greater demon of Nurgle, and the greater demon says, did you fulfill your purpose? And he says, yes, I did. And he opens up his armor, and he shows where, an empty chest cavity, which was all rotted out, was the Exterminatus nuke. And he nuked the demon and nuked everything, and Nurgle lost his foothold on that planet. So it was a really, really cool story. It was really captivating. I forget what it's called, but I'm sure people can find it. So I'm going to vote Nurgle. Even though Blood for the Blood God, Skulls for the Skull Throne is really, really cool. So, Mr. Tristan, anything in conclusion?
Yeah, I do have that. Even though we've been talking about Xenos and the Chaos, ignore all of these things and put your faith entirely within the Emperor. He is the master of mankind and the only one who should ever be followed in the 40K universe. Yeah. That's about it.
Otherwise, it's a heresy. So the Emperor protects mankind, but mankind protects the Emperor. So everybody, thank you so much for tuning in tonight. This is Boghammer 40K. Thank you, Tristan. Thank you, Nick. Thank you, Mitty. And thank you, Tater. So thank you, everybody, tuning in. We'll be back next week with our usual Bog content. We're talking about Germanic spirituality and philosophy and mythology and history and all that good stuff. So we'll be back talking about that stuff next week. Thank you again to Focus Farmer for the really, really great cooking episode. Man, I can't wait to get down and make the liver as he, because I'm a big fan of liver too. So I'm going to try to make it his.
Oh, way. It looked absolutely delicious.
Oh, it looked wonderful. So we're gonna try it, and I'll see you guys next time. Everybody stay safe right now, man. I know it's really tough out there. Everybody's quarantined. There's a lot of misery and a lot of pain and stuff like that. But I just want everybody to make sure that they're staying sane, they're staying safe, they're taking this seriously, they're looking out for their families, they're staying stocked up. And to everybody that sent me messages and stuff thanking me for the video I did telling everybody to get ready for this thing, you know, you're very welcome. All you guys, you're very welcome. The whole reason I do this is to help my folk, man, to help my brothers and sisters out there. And I really hope that the content I put out gave people a forewarning and helped people get ready and all that good stuff. So stay healthy, stay safe. Hail the gods, hail the folk. And I'll see you guys next time. Many blessings. Hail.